WPRN's Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lenman. My guest today is Robert Aberle. Bob is a professor of philosophy at Diablo Valley College in California. His books include Democracy Gone, Anatomy of Deception. It discusses the Iraq invasion, the occupation, preparation for the next deception. Bob is currently working on a new book. I'll let him comment on it on here. Before you come on, Bob, I simply want to mention, for the last 30 minutes, leading up to just a couple of minutes before the top of the hour, so I could make a very quick pit stop before coming on here myself, I was being interviewed by Press TV with two other guests on the Iranian election, and I would just say my first comment, what I said on it with Press TV, I extend my heartiest congratulations to Hassan Rouhani, the new president of Iran. Most people, including myself, expected a runoff. There were six candidates. There were eight originally, and in the past few days, two decided not to run. I don't know the reasons why, but they certainly were in the race, and they pulled out, and six were left. But of the six that were left, Mr. Rouhani got roughly three times the votes of his number two rival. So that's a very impressive victory. I honestly don't know very much about him, and now I have to learn about him, because in the weeks and months ahead, I will certainly be saying something about him. Bob, welcome.
Thank you, Stephen. It's great to talk to you again. And I know nothing about Rouhani either, because I was watching the last that I had seen. It looked like there was going to be a runoff, so I thought, well, I'll wait for the runoff, and then I'll start examining the candidates. But this is a surprise.
It really is a surprise. And the key question I was asked was, with new leadership in Iran, will American policy change? And I was unequivocal, Bob. I stressed that American policy is based on imperial interest. And I didn't phrase it this way, but I will now on air. It simply doesn't matter whether Ahmadinejad is president, Rouhani, or Mickey Mouse. American imperial policy is the same. America wants to be the regional and global hegemon, and unless a leader of any country goes along with what America wants, then it will get beaten up for whatever reason. The person can be a Democrat, a despot, or anything in between. American interests alone matter. The interests and the sovereignty of other countries are of no interest to America. They want them subordinated to what Washington wants, and that's what's going to be happening going forward.
Well, I think you're right. I think that explains also the Obama administration's complete hypocrisy regarding the difference of the situation in what he's saying about Syria and what he's saying about Turkey. So he's all upset that Assad is allegedly violating the rights of the citizens of Syria, but yet when Erdogan in Turkey does the exact same thing, dispersing the protesters by brutal violence and killing and injuring and jailing these protesters for exercising their free speech, Obama supports Erdogan. So the reason that you have that problem there, that hypocrisy, is because it's just a matter of who's going to do our bidding. Okay, Assad, you're not doing our bidding, we're coming after you. Okay, Erdogan, you're going to be our guy in Turkey, we're going to prop you up. And that's the way that works. And I think that one of the things that occurred to me a couple of weeks ago, John Kerry, when he was talking about the Assad regime, that term regime has become so problematic and so often used from the Bush administration now into the Obama administration. It's a regime if we don't like you. It's a president or a prime minister if we do like you. But anyway, one of the things that Kerry said in public was that Assad is not willing to follow international law, particularly the First Geneva Convention. So if he's not willing to follow the Geneva Convention, then we're going to start arming the rebels even more. And my first thought was, well, I can see three different bodies of international law that the United States isn't following and doesn't care about it. So which one do we want to pick here? I thought, okay, well, Kerry keeps going to Geneva 1, so let's go to Geneva 1. You look at the Geneva Convention, the First Geneva Convention, and one of the things it's very explicit about is that any neutral power who is looking at a conflict within a nation from outside is required that they have a sense of responsibility toward the parties of the conflict. Well, when you're arming one side and unilaterally and not paying attention to what the other side has to say, you're not showing a sense of responsibility. But even more than that, Article 50 of the First Geneva Convention talks about grave breaches of the Geneva Conventions, which includes willful killing, torturing, inhumane treatment, causing great suffering or serious injury and to body or health, extensive destruction that is not justified by military necessity and not carried out lawfully. That's what the United States is doing with their proxy war. So back to what you were saying, the idea that the United States should be interested in any body of law is shown to be complete false by the fact that there's these bodies of laws the United States won't follow, yet we're holding others to account for that.
Well, Bob, that is absolutely true. Hypocrisy stops short of explaining America's agenda, which is basically, you know, do what we say, not what we do, what we support. So you're right about Turkey. I wrote two articles on the protests going on in Turkey, and Prime Minister Erdogan is nothing short of a despot, a thug. He literally, I mean, he's ravaging his people. The notion of expressing peaceful opposition to things that anybody should have a right to their opinion on, and he sends in police thugs to attack them with rubber bullets and toxic tear gas and pepper spray, and literally attacking them, bludgeoning them, and now going after doctors treating injured people. Doctors are doing a pro bono volunteer work treating injured people in Turkey, and thousands of them have been hurt, some very seriously. And now Erdogan wants to go after the doctors and maybe arrest them, take away their medical licenses. I don't know what he wants to do, but this is the latest outrage that he's coming up with. So we see this going on in Turkey. In the situation in Syria, I've written so many articles on Syria, Bob. It's simply wrong to call what's going on a civil war. That's the term that's used over and over again. There's nothing civil about what's going on. Syria was invaded. Proxy death squads that Washington enlisted are waging the war in Syria. Al-Qaeda, a worse Al-Qaeda affiliate called Al-Nusra, and other extremist elements being brought in from dozens of regional countries and countries outside of the region, Afghanistan, Pakistan, some from Europe. There are even some Americans that are over there. It's shocking what's going on. So Syria is under a foreign invasion. The leader of any country, if their country is invaded or attacked, they have an obligation to defend the people of the country. Whenever Syrian forces liberate an area that was held by these so-called rebels, they're insurgents, they're mercenaries, they're death squads. It's a Salvador option that began before Central America in the 80s. This was the Phoenix operation in Vietnam, and then the Salvador operation in Central America, and now we saw it in Libya, we saw it in Iraq for a short period, we're seeing it now in Syria. These are killers, hired killers, and they're armed, and they're trained, and they're funded, and they're the ones responsible for using chemical weapons. There is hard, clear evidence that shows that these rebels multiple times have used sarin gas and other chemical weapons. Some of them were even bold enough, Bob, to make a video of what they were doing. So they documented their own crimes on videotape. It's all out there. Turkey, in the last few weeks, arrested 12 alleged al-Nusra fighters. The reports varied from 2 kilograms of sarin gas to 4 pounds of it. It was a lot of sarin gas. A drop of it could kill anybody. A tiny drop would kill you if you're exposed to it. And it's part of the evidence, Bob, that Washington has, which of course is all fabricated, that Assad has used chemical weapons, is either lung tissue. Oh, I'm sorry, blood samples from 2 people supposedly exposed to sarin gas. One died. Well, if you're exposed to sarin gas, you're going to die. And the other one is still alive. Washington claims this person was exposed to sarin gas. Well, that's impossible. If this person was exposed to sarin, the person would be dead. So blood samples from this living person is attributed to Assad. Well, I don't know how blood samples from anybody can be attributed to anybody unless you get eyewitnesses, unless you get clear, documented evidence. That's the only way to decide who did what to whom. But this isn't what Washington does. So it's a Colin Powell moment all over again, Bob. It's WMDs against Saddam that didn't exist. Well, sarin gas and other chemical weapons exist, but the issue is who's using them against whom and who isn't using them, who are the victims and who are the perpetrators, and what sense would it make for Assad to use chemical weapons? He is literally routing these rebel forces, these insurgent forces. What sense would it make for him to use something he doesn't need? Well, no sense whatsoever. He's very able to rout them with conventional weapons, and he's doing it. I want to let you jump in, Bob. I've got a couple of other points to make, which I'll continue after you make your comments. But I think part of what's going on with raising this issue now is changing the subject because of the NSA spying scandals, the IRS scandals, the dire economic situation in the country. So you need to change the subject. And I'll let you jump in, and then I'll give you some poll numbers I saw, which will be in an article I'll put out tomorrow.
Great. I thought of several things while you were talking. Back to the Assad regime and using chemical weapons, the first accusation of that from Obama came in April. And if you recall, the Assad regime responded by requesting that the United Nations send an inspection team. But the U.S. and Britain and France demanded that if they're going to send a team, that they be given completely unfettered access to the entire country and every Syrian facility in it. And Assad said, no, we just want you to come and investigate the chemical weapons allegation, the chemical weapons use. And the U.S. said, no, we're not sending anybody over there for that. And I'll add to what you said about the 12 people who were arrested with sarin gas. The understanding that the Turkish government came to from these people who were arrested was that they were preparing to launch another chemical weapons attack against a Turkish civilian population, and they were going to blame that on the Syrian government. So that's one of the problems that you have here now, is that you've got these rebels that the United States is supporting, as you said, the al-Nusra Front, and everybody knows it's an affiliate of al-Qaeda, or at least closely connected with it. And then you can top that off by saying that Carla Del Ponte, the leading member of the UN Commission on Inquiry about Syria, stated that the bulk of the evidence indicated that the chemical weapons that have been used were used by the rebels, not by the government. So here you have a United Nations commissioner saying it's not the government, it's the rebels. And even yesterday, the national, what's his title, Deputy National Security Advisor Ben Rhodes from the United States said that even though we have high confidence that it was the government that used it, he said that physiological evidence of the sarin gas exposure to the people that were tested don't tell us who was really responsible. And yet the Obama administration says, but we know the government did it anyway. So there's all kinds of conflicts and contradictions that are going on here, while at the same time it's being ignored that the majority of the Syrian people still support the government, and they're very much opposed to the Islamists who are working to overthrow it. So all of this stuff is being ignored, especially by U.S. media. And it's going to be another pretext for the United States to get more involved, establish no-fly zones, even though they say that's not coming. We're going to see this ramp up, and everybody in the mainstream media is ignoring it, and so they'll just do what they want. I'll let you back in.
Oh, they absolutely will do what they want, and I think this is planned. It's just a matter of how they're going to do it step by step. Two things, Bob. In a recent article, I quoted a poll that was sponsored by NATO, of all organizations, a NATO-sponsored poll. A private organization conducted the poll in Syria. And this was a very recent poll in the past 2-3 weeks or so. It showed that something on the order of 70% of Syrians back Assad, and this is exactly what happened in Libya during 2011. The longer the conflict persisted, the stronger the support grew for Gaddafi. And the reason is, who else do the people have to turn to for support when their country is being attacked? So NATO was bombing Libya. the only support the Libyan people had was what Gaddafi could give them. Syria has been invaded. The only support the Syrian people have, all the Syrian people, because they're all vulnerable to these attacks, even if they're not in the line of fire, if they're in an area where the so-called rebels are attacking, well, a bomb goes off, a car bomb, or whatever these people are unleashing, anybody too close to where this is happening can be injured, can be killed, and many people have. I wanted to raise another poll. The New York Times has it on its website today. It has poll numbers from a number of organizations, and then it has a consensus average of all of them. Well, when U.S. Respondents are asked, do you support America intervening in Syria, Americans oppose it 64% to 26%. When the question is rephrased to ask, if Assad has used chemical weapons against his people, do you support America intervening? 58% of the respondents support it, 30% oppose it. So literally, the opposition and support reverses depending on the question, Bob. Of course, the real question would be, as far as chemical weapons goes, who really is using these things? Who are the perpetrators? Who are the victims? But the pollsters, at least in what the New York Times published, did not ask that question. But it shows that public sentiment can be manipulated the wrong way. American people, for the most part, get their news not in independent programs like this one. They watch Fox, they watch CNN, and they think they're getting news. They're being fed lies, misinformation, managed news. They certainly aren't being told the truth. But if they listen to legitimate news and read legitimate news on alternative websites, they would know what's going on. They would know who are the victims and who are the perpetrators. There's no question that as far as I'm concerned, Assad has always been an authoritarian leader. He certainly isn't a despot on the order of Saddam or America's good friends in the Gulf. The leaders of Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, Qatar, United Arab Emirates, oh, these are lovely people. You would not want to cross them. You would not do too well if you did it. But these are America's best friends in the region, not to mention Israel, that is a viciously apartheid state. 20% of the Israeli population is Arab, but you'd never know that they were Israeli citizens because they're virtually stripped of their rights, and Israel basically wants them gone, and they're doing their best to make life so onerous for them that they hope they'll just leave of their own accord. And, of course, occupied Palestine, we know what's going on there. It is nightmarish, and it's not getting any better. It's getting worse. Heaven knows what's going to happen to Syria, Bob. I'm afraid Israel is very much involved in that war as well. They may get more than they bargained for if they want Assad replaced. They may find on their doorstep the kind of people they really wish never were there in the first place. But there is hard evidence, Bob, that Israel is actively arming and consorting with al-Qaeda and al-Nusra elements in Syria.
We can add to that the when was it? Earlier this week, I think it was Tuesday, that there were 60 people that were killed in a civilian massacre of Shia Muslims by the Syrian rebels. I can't remember what province it was in, but the result from that was that the Sunni clerics, particularly those in a couple of the countries that you just mentioned, Saudi Arabia and Qatar in particular, the Sunni clerics are now calling for a jihad. Now, when you get Israel's hardline alleged Judaism involved with what now the Sunnis are saying, this has got to be a jihad because what these rebels are doing to our people, now you're really going to inflame tensions. And so one of the things that I don't think the United States is banking on is the possible consequences that could come about if these Muslim clerics actually were successful in inflaming religious tensions so that it becomes a jihad, which means that it's an all-out war against the other on religious grounds. Now, the most vicious fighting can occur when you're fighting for a religion. So if the Sunni clerics that are calling for a jihad are successful, we're in for one brutal time in Syria and all around, and that might spill over into Israel, so you never know. You'd also mentioned Libya. I want to bring up something about Libya, too, because I read this week. Actually, it was yesterday in the newspaper. Something that the mainstream media tends to ignore is the unrest and the violence that's going on in Libya right now. And there are two things that have popped up that I think are important to discuss. And that, first of all, is the Libya Shield Force, one of the Islamist militias that the Libyan government has been using to maintain law and order. That's an interesting combination, too. NATO comes in with the United States and puts in their own government in Libya, and that Libyan government then uses the Islamist militias to help it bring things under control. But anyway, this Libya Shield Force, this Islamist militia, fired on demonstrators this week, and they killed 31 people and injured 127 people in Benghazi because they were protesting the fact that the Libyan government is lined up with the Islamist militias. And the that Islamist militia, because they now have so much power in Libya, they have gotten pushed through the parliament in Libya what they call the political isolation law, which bans anyone from holding government a government office position that had that position under Gaddafi. And that got through the parliament, and so there were several resignations that had to occur in the Libyan government. And now the successors that are being discussed to replace these people who had to resign under the new law are very shady characters. I mean, they're all connected with al-Qaeda, or they're regular members of al-Qaeda. So now the government is going to have to deal with the fact that you have an al-Qaeda government that's growing in Libya and a lot of tension and unrest among the people because they're not really sanguine about this. They don't really like this at all. And at the same time, the economy is in a tailspin. So Libya is by no means a settled issue. So we need to keep that in mind, too. We're going to have to go back to Libya. We never got out of Iraq. We're still going to be there. And now we want to go to Syria, too?
It's madness, Bob. It is absolute madness. You have to wonder, what on earth? I can appreciate imperial desires, an imperial agenda. You know, the urge to want to dominate. I can appreciate that. But usually imperial powers go a little bit too far. The late Chalmers Johnson referred to it as overreach or overstretch. I think maybe he used both terms. And, you know, you simply go beyond what you're capable of doing, even the world's supreme superpower, and you find out that you simply cannot go beyond a certain point. And this is what happens to all imperial powers. They simply don't realize the limits of what they can accomplish to achieve their ends. They go beyond them, and they end up coming a cropper because of what they're doing. Yeah, America really has a mess on its hands just in the Middle East. And now that this so-called pivot, this Asia pivot, where by 2020, the plan is to divert 60% of America's military might or naval might to the Pacific region. And, of course, the obvious target is China, and China's well aware of it. You get Russia as well, the eastern part of Russia. In that area as well, and you ally Russia and China together very strongly against Imperial America. I mean, that alone is a mighty, mighty force, tough force to go up against. But the Middle East is proving to be a much tougher nut than maybe American planners thought it would be. So you're right. I mean, there is literally a cauldron of violence every single day in Libya, in Iraq. The Afghan war could go on for another generation if America doesn't decide to pull out. And there's no plan whatever to pull out. There is a plan for permanent occupation of Afghanistan, of Iraq, and whatever America is doing in Libya. Ideally, America would like proxy forces doing the heavy lifting in Libya, but they're not doing the job. There's a puppet government installed with a phony election. You've got the same situation in Iraq, the same situation in Afghanistan. This guy Karzai, he's barely the mayor of Kabul, the capital. This guy without a marine division or something guarding him out in the open wouldn't last 2 minutes. He'd be assassinated. I mean, he's a phony. He's a former CIA asset. He was formerly connected with Union Oil. He was installed. Again, you get these phony elections. So this is a situation. And, of course, the Taliban, which back in the 1980s were called freedom fighters by Ronald Reagan, I mean, they want their country back. I don't support the Taliban. on. I don't like people like this. I wouldn't want to live in a country run by these kind of people. But I can appreciate what they want, and I support what they want. They want the independence of their country, and I agree with them on that. And they're fighting for it. And these are very mean and nasty fighters, Bob. I mean, they've been fighting for over 10 years. They'll fight for another 10 years. They'll fight for 30 years. Eventually, they're going to win. How many people will die before this war finally ends? I don't think I'll live long enough to see it end, unless we get some sane people running the country, Bob. I don't see any in sight, but if it ever happens, maybe they'll realize how stupid and arrogant and wasteful, not to mention illegal, that this war and all the others are, and decide to call a halt to them. I should live so long, Bob.
Well, we all should. I wouldn't put my hopes on anything that you just talked about in terms of any type of sane leader coming up. They're all co-opted by capitalism in the United States, and since we're the reigning empire, that's what we have to deal with. That the capitalist domination spirit is infectious in our very leaders. The whole idea is that's how we became a third world country in the United States. We replaced citizenship and the common good with individualist capitalism, and that has a philosophy built into it of hierarchy and dominance. And the end result from that is that we're going to extend that dominance as far as we can. Not we, but I mean our leaders. And it's not just the NSA spying that is part of that extension, but I'm sure you read yesterday or the day before that Edward Snowden revealed yet another bombshell, that Washington has been hacking into computers in Hong Kong and mainland China, he presented documents coming out of the NSA showing that the Obama administration has been doing that, and that absolutely put the lie to what Obama's been saying for 4 months about China is the greatest military cyber threat in the world today. And yet it turns out that the United States has been targeting Hong Kong university students, businesses, public officials, getting their specific dates and addresses of their emails and what they're doing on the web. The success rate from getting all that information was something around 75%, and they're planning on cyber attacks. And in fact, some cyber attacks have already gone on from the United States into Hong Kong and the Chinese, but against civilian computers. Just, they're testing themselves, their system out. So it's not just military domination, but it's also now cyber war that the Obama administration has taken us to. And apparently this has affected like tens of millions of people. There's another whistleblower that was in the news this week, probably earlier than this, but I just read about it this week. Matthew Aid, a U.S. intelligence expert, came out in Foreign Policy magazine this month. Actually, it was probably just about a week ago or less, talking about the Maryland-based Office of Tailored Access Operations, TAO, that's its acronym, where they're collecting information and preparing cyber war against the People's Republic of China. That's what their whole point is. Obama has been inserting their power more and more, and now they're the top power in the United States engaging in limited cyber war against the Chinese. So we're going to attack China with computers, and we're going to attack the Mideast with our military and have the military in the back, hopefully, according to Obama, for the Asia pivot. And interestingly enough, something happened with regard to all of this cyber warfare at the U.S.-China summit last weekend. Obama sneaked something into the discussion that he did not tell the president of China. I can't remember his name. He didn't tell him that he was going to put this in, but he started talking about cybersecurity and cyber hacking and all of that. And the end result from that was that China's top internet official responded by saying if Obama didn't be quiet about that, that China was going to release in public what he called mountains of data about U.S. cyber hacking into Chinese government computers. So Edward Snowden gets some of that documentation and produces that this week. I don't think it's gotten any media play in the United States at all. I had to dig this up myself, but that's the latest revelation, that we're hacking and engaging in cyber war with Chinese and Hong Kong computers.
Oh, we sure are, Bob. We need to take a break, and I'll continue this when we come back. But I wrote about U.S. hacking in China. That's an article that's on my blog site today, Steve Lindman blog. It's also posted on Global Research, and my article was referring to the NSA chief, Keith Alexander, lying in testimony to Congress. He committed perjury. He's a perjurer. Well, we'll pick up on that when we get back. Short break. Bob Everly, talking about Syria, NSA spying, hacking, U.S. hacking. You know, Bob, we know this. You hear reports often about America accusing China of hacking in America. Well, maybe China does hack. Maybe all countries do some hacking against many other countries. But the granddaddy of all hackers and spies and breakers of fundamental rule of law principles, without question, the world champion is America, and Snowden is spilling a lot of information. This man, Abe, that you just mentioned, I just pulled up his article during the break, and I'll read it after the program, and I'll probably comment on it in another article that I write. But the one I put out this morning, I refer to Keith Alexander, the head of the NSA, testifying before Congress and lying, which is just what they always do. And, you know, they get before a committee. He went before an appropriations committee. I know he's testified before intelligence committees, probably the House and the Senate. And these people act, the people in committees, they act like they don't know anything. Well, I'm certain that everybody in Congress doesn't know everything about what's going on, but the leaders of these key committees, the power brokers in Congress, they know full well what's going on. Nothing is being fooled. So Keith Alexander can sit in front of them and say, well, oh, I didn't do this. We did this. We did not do this. And they can separate the truth from the lies. But when this guy is really lying, bald-faced lies about we're not hacking and we're not spying on everybody, I mean, clear evidence shows that's exactly what's going on. And more evidence comes out all the time. I'm sure China's having a field day with Snowden right now, Bob. I can't imagine that China would extradite Snowden to America.
Well, that's why he's there. I'm guessing that's why he's there, because China's not going to extradite him. That's probably the safest place for him to be. So, and you got to add not just Alexander to your list, but James Clapper, too. He perjured himself as well.
Oh, absolutely.
And he got caught this week red-handed, and they said, wait a minute, here's what you said. Here's what the reality is now, because the leaks from Snowden. And he said, you probably heard what he said, that his excuse for lying was, well, I told the least untruthful thing I could.
I didn't get that quote.
Yeah, that's what he said. I did the least untruthful thing, which means I just perjured myself a little because it was the least perjury that I could do. And I saw the video of him doing that, where when he was answering these questions and lying about it, he had his head down and he had his hand on his forehead bent down so nobody could see his eyes or his face when he was lying, and he was just lying through his teeth, and then tried to make up for it by saying, well, I just lied in the least untruthful way that I could. Now, these people should be the ones that everybody's pointing the finger at, going, wait a minute, you perjured yourself. You're the one that should be prosecuted. But instead, everybody's going, let's get Snowden. And so you're not just killing the messenger, but you're flipping the whole thing around. The people who take an oath of office are the ones who have violated that oath, and yet they're the ones that are getting off scot-free again.
for getting off scot-free, Bob. For listeners who don't know who James Clapper is, he's director of national intelligence. So he's the big guy in America when it comes to national intelligence. And what authority he has over all the intelligence operations. It's not all of them, really, but he's in charge of a lot of major intelligence operations. The Pentagon has its own. At least every branch of the military has its own intelligence operations, so they run their own. But Clapper has a very important job. One of the quotes I picked up from him, Bob, was when either a senator, I think it was a senator, but I don't remember, it might have been Ron Wyden, asked him, is NSA spying on everybody in America? And his answer was the answer I saw was two words: no, sir.
Yeah, right.
A very easy quote to remember. Again, he was lying through his teeth.
Yep. And there's somebody that, you had mentioned Keith Alexander, General Keith Alexander, but James Bamford wrote an article this week talking about Alexander as being far more powerful than even Clapper is. And he went through all the things that he's in charge of, and he makes the case that no one has ever had more power in America than General Keith Alexander right now. The number of people under his command, the number of people who are spying under his orders. He's got three different job titles, I guess. The National Security Agent, Director of National Security Agency, the Chief of Central Security Service, and in charge of the U.S. Cyber Command. He's got his own secret military. He presides over the Navy's 10th Fleet, and also some Army and Air Force connections as well. He's built up quite an empire, but he's kind of a secretive guy, and nobody really knows anything about him except that he's kind of the head behind all of this. And so Clapper is important, but it looks to me like Keith Alexander is even more important, and he's somebody that needs to be watched. If anybody needs to be spied on, he does. He's got too much power that he wields at his own discretion. So he's somebody that we should be watching.
And he's a four-star general, which scares me as well. I didn't realize there were two commands I knew he had. I didn't realize he had so much more. But this is the kind of guy that military coups are made out of. These are the kind
right.
of people who launch them.
Right. Yeah, and I wouldn't say that's coming, but that's certainly somebody that has a lot of power. And I don't remember whether it was him or someone else who testified before Congress that all of this power is justified under the authorization for the use of military force that the Congress gave in terms of the ability of the military to go after the people who were responsible for 9/11. They're using that in order to violate the Constitution as well and say, well, we need all this power. This is all really important for us because we're doing what it is that the AUMF told us to do, and that is go after all these al-Qaeda people. So this is really a morass of corruption that we have gotten ourselves into.
Bob, I would argue
that. I need to tell you this because it's going to happen here in just a second. My doorbell's going to ring and the dog is going to go nuts barking because there are some Jehovah's Witnesses that are about to ring my doorbell, just so you know.
Well, if your dog has a comment on what we're talking about, please put him or her on. I'd be very happy to hear it. And I'll let you translate.
Yeah, okay.
Bob, I will say this about AUMF. There is only one authority that can declare war, and it's not the U.S. Congress. It's the Security Council. International law is very clear. America is a signatory to the UN Charter, obviously. It's a UN member. It literally was responsible for crafting the UN Charter, 1947 or so, whenever it was, San Francisco. Well, the UN Charter is very clear and unequivocal. Only the Security Council has final say on who can go to war and who cannot go to war. The only reason a nation can attack another reason is if it is attacked or if an attack against it is so imminent that it needs to do something in its own self-defense. But even then, it can only persist in doing this until a Security Council acts. It has the sole final authority over war and peace. So for the Congress to pass AUMF, it is it's an unconstitutional act because every treaty and convention that America signs on to automatically becomes U.S. law under the Supremacy Clause of the Constitution. So the Congress and this law unconstitutional, not to mention all the other unconstitutional laws that Congress passes, and the ones I would stress are the provisions of the U.S. Constitution are fundamental in America, and I would put it this way. Congress may pass no law that contradicts or subverts in any way any provision of the U.S. Constitution. Doing so is unconstitutional. The courts have an obligation to override it, throw it out, and I would argue that anybody supporting these kind of laws are guilty, dare I say, treason, violating the Constitution. They have no place in government. They should be put out of government. They should be prosecuted. There are many lawyers in the Congress. They understand these things. And even members who aren't lawyers, they have all kinds of advices. They know the law. They know what's legal to do and what's illegal to do. If they put their name on an illegal act, they have committed a crime. They should be prosecuted for it. Well, my goodness, I think virtually everybody in Congress, I think there was one negative vote against AUMF, and I think it was 99-0 in the Senate. I'd have to check that. And I think there was one vote. Barbara Lee, I think, in the House was the only vote against it. So the whole House and the whole Senate supported it. All of these people who were still in Congress are war criminals, and the ones who are out of Congress are war criminals. They should all be prosecuted.
Yeah, you're hitting upon a very important point there, that, and I think that really needs to be reiterated time and again, that whatever the United States has signed on to in terms of its international obligations, in terms of international law, that is law for us, too. And I think you were making reference to Article 2 of the UN Charter, that you can't use force unless you're under imminent threat, or whether you're, so that would be self-defense, and that, or that... there's one part of Article 2 that talks about if you've got the consent of the host state, you can go to war.
Well, I'm not familiar with that. But I think the Security Council probably would still have to sign off on it because there are other provisions in the Charter and other international law that also are very unequivocal. No nation may interfere in the internal affairs of any other for any reason except in self-defense.
Right, that's it. That's the issue, the self-defense issue. So, and that's what precisely the United States is doing. So, again, we're back to what we started with when I was talking about John Kerry at the top of the hour, that he wants to hold Syria accountable for international law, and the United States violates international law left and right. I mean, if you look at the international human rights laws that the United States violates by their drone strikes in Pakistan and Afghanistan and Yemen, they violate consistently almost every law that's listed under international humanitarian law. There's all kinds of distinctions that are important, the issues of distinction between combatant and non-combatant, the distinctions of proportionality, the distinctions of military necessity. All that gets just blown away by a single drone strike, which just hits mosques, funerals, schools, elders that gather, and the most pernicious of all, the signature strikes, that if somebody engages in a particular pattern of behavior, that Obama himself says, well, that looks like a terrorist, let's strike him. Well, that's exactly what the NSA is doing with their spying right now. They're setting up signature patterns for people in terms of their emails and their phone calls to see who would represent a threat to their power. That's a dictatorship, by the way, but we can get into that later. But all these things about international law, the International Red Cross law, international humanitarian law, they're being violated by the United States almost every letter, as well as the spirit of the law, on a regular basis. And that's U.S. domestic law, too. And you were talking about Article 2 of the U.S. Constitution. We've got to follow these laws. Otherwise, we can't make any higher claim to following the rule of law or hold anybody else to it without complete hypocrisy. And I've often wondered how John Kerry and Barack Obama and their minions sleep at night, because they're telling everybody else what to do, knowing full well that they violate that same thing. How do you say that in public without breaking up in laughter? I mean, when I hear those guys talk, I laugh. I can't imagine that the media doesn't do the same thing.
Well, of course, the media that I call the scoundrel media, Bob, they march in lockstep with these lawless policies. And they literally support these illegal wars of aggression. They're beating up on Edward Snowden now for being a courageous whistleblower. On Friday on this program, I discussed the 1989 Whistleblower Protection Act, where any government employee is supposed to be protected to be able to expose government wrongdoing. It is really a noble act, but nobody can take recrimination against them for doing it. They should put a medal on these people. Instead, they're vilified and they're beaten up as criminals, all kinds of wrongful things said about them, and all the other laws. Nothing is more important than the laws of war and peace, and the idea that you wage war aggressively and you claim you're doing it as a humanitarian gesture or a responsibility to protect. I mean, this is such rubbish when America literally destroys countries, kill millions of people. Millions of people since 9/11 have been killed either by direct violence, direct wars, deprivation, hunger, homelessness, disease, countless millions. It's astonishing the body count, the legitimate body count at the hands of America. America claiming that it goes into liberate countries. Well, the only liberation these millions of people get are in their graves when they don't have to worry about American bombs and missiles and invaders anymore. But this is the kind of agenda that America follows. And the people in Congress who know the laws, they break them flagrantly, and they go on one after another. One country is ravaged, on to the next one, on to the next one, multiple wars being fought, proxy wars being fought. I've written about, the Washington Post even wrote about, 120 countries have U.S. special forces in them. They're there for the most part covertly. They certainly aren't there for anything humanitarian. They're there for mischief. You've got CIA infesting countries everywhere. They're there for mischief. There are terrible crimes being committed. Is anybody paying attention? Is any of this being reported? It's a rare article in a publication like the Washington Post that will admit that U.S. special forces are in 120 or more countries. That's around two-thirds of the, almost two-thirds of the countries in the world. I'm wondering what countries don't have these forces in them. And important countries like Iran, there's been so much covert activities waged against Iran, short of hot war, assassinations, facilities targeted with explosions, cyber war, all kinds of destabilization activities. And this goes on there. I don't know what goes on. Whenever you hear about some kind of a terror attack somewhere, the first thing that should pop in anybody's mind, Mop, is, who really is responsible for this? Is this a U.S. false flag? Is this being done against somebody to be blamed on the victim? That's the first thing that always pops in my mind. There's no question in my mind that 9/11 was a false flag. The Boston bombings were false flags. So many others. I've written about dozens of Muslims. Post 9/11, America went to war against Islam. I've written on 60 or 70 individual cases, mostly men, a few women. I've yet to find a single person accused of and convicted of either terrorism or conspiracy to commit it, who committed any single crime. These were people set up. They did absolutely nothing, and yet they were convicted, they were in prison, and they're rotting, serving long prison terms. This is the policy of America in furthering their imperial policies, and the members of Congress are directly responsible for this going on, and lawyers who defend the wrong clients become vulnerable. And my friend Lynn Stewart, who is literally dying a slow death on cancer that spread to multiple parts of her body, who's been cleared for compassionate release maybe 6 weeks ago, and she's still rotting in a prison hospital that refuses to give her treatment where she could get the kind of treatment she needs if it isn't too late, in a public hospital back home in New York, but they haven't released her, and I'm not certain they're going to.
Well, that goes back to the totalitarian form of government that we seem to have gotten ourselves into. And that connects up with the killing of Ibrahim Todashev from the Boston Marathon bombing as well. Buried in the U.S. media, this whole thing of why was he killed and why is it that the FBI's stories were so conflicted by the facts that were brought out afterwards. The FBI lied repeatedly about how and why they killed this guy. My suspicion, I don't have a lot of evidence for this except circumstantial, my suspicion is he knew something or some things that would have further embarrassed the United States government. Maybe he knew what you were talking about, that this was a complete setup, the bombing. But whatever it was, and that's what you're referring to with your friend Lynn Stewart, too, that the any dissenter gets killed in some way. You get either alienated or they'll just outright kill you. And I think that the next time that something like this happens, and as I've said in public talks I've given, even before the Boston Marathon bombing, this is going to happen again, and it's going to happen again and again and again. Why? Because we started this fight. I mean, you can go all the way back to the overthrow of Mossadegh in Iran in the 1950s. You could probably go back even further than that. We have been meddling in the affairs of other people for decades, half a century or better. And it's starting to come back to us now, and it will continue to come back to us, and yet all you hear about is these people who are attacking us are terrorists. So it's a one-way accusation with absolutely no self-reflection about what is it that our government is doing that provokes these attacks. And I would say that if somebody would just stand up and say, look, if we start shutting down some of our military bases in areas where the people clearly don't want us, and if we stop trying to wage war against the world will stop trying to terrorize us. So if that's the case, then who's the terrorist? It's our own government. Our own government is using terror abroad, and then it comes back to us, and they call that terrorism, and then they use that to clamp down even further on domestic activities. So this is kind of a circle that keeps going on under the blanket of terrorism, in which the original and most important terrorist, the United States government, is not being called to account for their terrorism. And yet it comes back to us on occasion, and then we double down on the security state. It's a real mess. But the beginning of the solution is we have to change our life. We have to change our styles of consumption, our need to have militaries control oil supplies. There's a lot that has to be changed, but this notion of dominance and consumption, that's got to be changed first and foremost.
It sure does, Bob. Literally doing the things, supporting the beast is what I call it, supporting these mega corporations that are literally the power behind the government in Washington, whether it's the banks or the big oil companies or the big pharmaceutical companies, the big auto companies. These represent the real power of the country, especially Wall Street and anything connected with America's war machine. They basically make the rules. They decide things, and they're the ones that pull off these false flags or want the false flags pulled off to benefit themselves, to heighten fear and get the public to go along with waging these imperial wars. And they just go on and on and on. There will be more incidents like this, like the Boston incident, which I think absolutely was a false flag. The younger brother, Tamerlan, couldn't speak. He was shot in the throat. He couldn't speak until late in May. He had a six-minute conversation with his mother. The comments were published in the London Telegraph, the Daily Telegraph in London, and he said to his mother, "We had nothing to do with this. We had nothing to do with this." I was amazed that I saw that in print. I don't think any U.S. newspaper published that. So everybody thinks that these guys were the bad guys, but they weren't the bad guys. An organization called Clarity International was complicit with the FBI. They were right there, a dozen of them in military-style outfits, civilian, but very military-style looking, with combat boots and so on. And they were there with the FBI right at the scene, the Clarity people. This is a Blackwater-type organization, and they were there. And I think there's no question that these were the ones responsible. So you blame it on a victim, and then you pursue the policies that you want to go ahead with. Bob, we're just about out of time. I want to give you the last word.
We never got to one of the main issues that I think needs to be discussed today, and maybe we can do this next time we get on, and that's environmentalism and the environment and what we're doing to the planet. The more I read about it, the more concerned I become about it. And there were several reports that were released in mid to late May that really merit some discussion. So, the facts aren't very nice, and I suspect that your listeners probably do know what they're about. I mean, we've raised the temperature of the Earth by almost a full degree. If we keep going like we are, even if we stop putting CO2 in the atmosphere, we're going to raise it by almost another degree within the next decade, and that will be the 2 degrees Celsius warming that scientists said will prevent or will bring about catastrophic change in the planet. And there are studies that were published in May that have demonstrated what's already going on, and maybe I'll just wait until next time and we can talk about that next time.
Well, Bob, I look forward to the next time. I agree with you. I think the end game for humanity is either a mushroom-shaped cloud or the destruction of the environment. It's no joke. It's just a question of which comes first. The environment takes longer. The mushroom-shaped cloud could happen this afternoon. It's a terrible thought to end the program with, Bob, but it's a reality we live with every day. Bob, it was great having you back on. I look forward to next time. I'll send you an email after I get off here. And today is Saturday. Join us on Sunday. We'll have another marvelous program, another great guest schedule. These issues and others will be raised and discussed. Do join us on Fridays also at 11 a.m. Eastern Time, weekends at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Make it a regular habit.